trusted voice of truth and light.
God gave me a gift. I shovel well. I shovel very well.
And a rally point for those who've accepted the reality that they are not sheep.
We've got a blind date with destiny.
And it looks like she's ordered the lobster.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Well, hello there and welcome to the show. Each week, I absolutely look forward to the opportunity to visit with my friend Eric Peters from EricPetersAutos.com. Eric is back, and Eric, it's become kind of a habit. There's no shortage of new weirdness to have to address. Monkeypox now is right on the top of our minds.
Yeah, you and I are old enough to remember disco fever. Now we've got ape fever.
All right. I got to get your take on this. We laugh only because there's really nothing left to do but laugh. But hey, the World Health Organization is meeting to consider this big treaty about how to standardize pandemic response in every nation that signs on to it. And lo and behold, there's a brand new pandemic apparently breaking out.
Yeah, you know, this reminds me on the comedic side of the old series Get Smart. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Which made a parody of spying and intelligence gathering, and they just went over the top with ridiculous, cheesy things. And, you know, here we are, monkeypox. Come on, for crying out loud. And that's why I refer to it as ape fever. They keep coming up with one progressively more ridiculous name for what's supposed to scare us out of our britches after another. You know, like you and I were talking about off the air, you got to wonder how much longer are people going to continue to fall for it. It's almost like a pratfall routine, you know, just one thing after the next. But then there's the non-comedic side, which is this extremely alarming international agreement that they're trying to put forward by executive fiat because they haven't got the ability to pass it as a treaty would normally be passed by the Senate and would then become essentially a superseding of whatever laws are in force in this country, to give the WHO, the World Health Organization, which is basically China, the Chinese are behind the WHO, the ability to dictate to Americans how they're going to be herded like cattle the next time they screech, pandemic, ape fever, everybody locked down.
I'm really hoping, and maybe I'm just whistling past the graveyard on this one, Eric, but it seems like people reached a point where finally they just said enough. And when the polling numbers reflected that people had reached that number, lo and behold, that's when people in authority, the ruling class, backed off with the mandates, backed off with, you know, jab or job stuff. But I have a sense that this is all going to come rushing back. And I have no idea how many people are going to draw the line and say, no, I'm not going to fall for it again.
Yeah. You know, I'm waiting with bated breath to see about that, too. And I don't think it's a coincidence. I generally don't believe in coincidences when they're too coincidental. That all of a sudden we're hearing about the dreaded monkeypox / ape fever at just the moment that this treaty is being put forward and pushed onto the populace. And the timing couldn't be better. You know, they're getting ready to do something, which they have to do, I think, about the pending midterm elections, because that has the possibility of being a mass repudiation of all of this, and they simply can't allow that to happen. So I do expect them to try something very dirty, and this may well be it. And I guess we're just going to have to wait and see how many people are going to be willing to do it again, yet again.
Well, and there's talk that the U.S. has actually bought millions of doses of monkeypox vaccine. So I have to wonder if there's another mandate waiting in the wings, you know, to be foisted on the American public as well as other populations. Well,
and doesn't it beg the question, where did this monkeypox vaccine come from? How is it that they had, I think the figure is something like 100 million individual vaccines or shots, or however you want to put it, for this pox, which nobody had heard about or was talking about, you know, outside of a very few small circles, just a month or so ago. How did they anticipate that? What another coincidence. Kind of like just before the pandemic Mark 1 with the Rona, a couple of months literally before that, they had this mock scenario of a world pandemic happening with the usual suspects behind it. So, you know, you and I have talked before about how they've become just blatant about it. They're not even attempting really to hide what they've got up their sleeves. If you know, just keep your ears open and pay attention, you can see they practically tell us, you know, they're that bold now that they're just willing to put it right out there and say, yep, this is what's coming. And there's nothing that you can do about it.
It's really hard not to go full Alex Jones when you see this stuff start to play out, especially where it's all just happening one after another after another. The best advice I've seen so far this week was someone said, you really need to get a friend who's a conspiracy theorist to explain to you what's about to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, as far as Alex, I don't know the man. I've not been on his show. But he has been right about a lot of things. I wish he weren't so over the top and for that reason come across as a kind of a cartoon type figure and constantly trying to sell his products for male vitality and all of that, because I think it undermines his message. A lot of his messaging was spot on, especially if you go back, you know, 5 years ago or 10 years ago and listen to what he was saying, which at the time did sound completely crazy and over the top tinfoil and all of that. But by and large, the guy was on the money.
Yep. And because he was on the money, that doesn't mean that anybody else who notices these things must be as unhinged or, you know, as over the top as Alex Jones. I mean, look, you can be a kook and you can still get it right. But it seems like, as you mentioned, it's not like this is being kept in the dark anymore. I mean, come on, the World Economic Forum is meeting in Davos right now. They're very open about what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you and I and others, I think, have been very careful to not be, you know, over the top, to not yell while we're talking, and to not make exaggerated claims that we can't support with facts, to be nuanced and reasonable. And I think that's very important. And I think anybody who adopts that attitude can see for themselves what's going on. You know, it's not a matter of trying to hawk some kind of so-called air fingers quotes conspiracy when it's right there and it's a fact. You know, it is a fact that the WHO is attempting to establish a de facto world government in the name of health. And it is a fact that the government of this country and a number of other countries are preparing to sign on board of that and thereby sign away our right to have any kind of real control over what the government does to us. You know, we're told constantly that we live in a democracy. Well, what good is a democracy when your representatives literally cannot, by law, do anything to counteract an international treaty and are essentially just kind of like low rent. I don't know what the word would be, but they're not meaningfully representatives in the way that we're told that they supposedly are.
Right. Just functionaries. There to carry out the wishes of those above them. And this is the part that gets me. It's not just, you know, that, oh, wow, here comes a pandemic and somebody's going to want to initiate lockdowns. If I'm reading this correctly, and please feel free to give me your thoughts on this, mm-hmm. too. It's the implementation of central bank digital currency, the social credit scores that go along with that, vaccine passports, or at least, you know, some kind of a health passport. This is about getting everybody into a system in which you operate through the approval of those who are in power.
Yeah, they're all tied together and they're all necessary to establish what they want. You know, if they can digitize currency, they can eliminate all anonymity, all privacy and transactions. They have utter control over you because they have utter economic control over you. And then they'll use their social credit regime to enforce all of that by basically threatening people that, you know, if you hold heretical, wrongthinkful views, if you don't behave, if you don't wear your mask, you don't get a shot, well, then they'll simply turn off your ability to buy anything. You know, at least previously during pandemic Mark One, we still have cash. We still have the ability to buy things without the government knowing about it, to work side gigs, and thereby to end run some of this tyranny. But when they have absolute control over your money and they have absolute control over what you can think and do, then they have absolute control over you. And that's what their purpose is here.
Well, as much as we saw people pushed to the margins of society with the mandates and the coercion to get everybody vaccinated, I know I'm not alone in this, but I actually found I'm okay with being excommunicated from polite society. If that's what it takes, I will live a more difficult existence, but I will be free. I'll make my own decisions. Thank you.
Yes, I agree with that heartily, but it would be a whole lot more difficult to do that if we have to revert to kind of an Amish or Amish, I was mispronounced, that barter type system where we can no longer use the official legal tender of the realm. So that may ultimately prove to be a good thing, you know. Silver and gold, I'm the advocate of sound money that can't be defrauded by central banks and can't be defrauded by government and used to control and manipulate people in the way that fiat currency can. I'm all for that. And I agree with you, you know, if we end up having to lead a more challenging life, that's not necessarily a worse life.
No. In fact, I think you and I have talked about this before. Freedom itself always carries a little bit of discomfort because there's mm-hmm. uncertainty. But that discomfort is still better than the comfort of, well, at least, you know, my shackles rest lightly. And look how shiny they are. Aren't they beautiful?
Mm-hmm. Well, isn't it, in a sense, the discomfort of adulthood? You know, children live in a nice, comfortable little bubble because their parents take care of them. They provide their needs. They, you know, keep the roof over their head. Kids don't have to worry about where their food is coming from, and they can play and they can have a good time. And when you're a child, that's normal and natural, and you can feel comfortable. With adulthood comes that uncertainty. You know, you have to think about, well, I've got to figure out a way to pay my bills, you know, and that's a little unsettling. But then there's this great feeling of empowerment that comes from being able to pay them.
Amen.
And from empowering yourself and all of these other good things.
Okay, hold that thought. We are talking with Eric Peters from ericpetersautos.com. We'll be back right after these messages.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Welcome back to the show. Eric Peters from ericpetersautos.com is my guest. I actually have a link to his website in my show notes, so I hope you'll take advantage of that. Read the wonderful articles and the great comments that follow. Eric, I noticed you've touched on double-digit pumps, and boy, mm-hmm. gas prices. Yep. I'm as concerned about them as I am about anything, because they really do have a far-reaching impact on just about every aspect of our lives.
Sure. It's like throwing a rock into a small pond. You can see the ripples that emanate from where the rock hit the water. It's not just the cost of fueling up your vehicle. It's the cost of fueling trucks and fueling agriculture and everything else that we need to live. You know, they are usurping us by making energy scarce and expensive. And California is the tip of the spear, not surprisingly, because California is probably the most, or at least one of the most woke leftist progressive, I despise that term, socialist states in the country. That's the accurate term for what they are. And, you know, in California, they are beginning to recalibrate the pumps to anticipate double-digit gas prices. Gas prices are already pushing $7 a gallon.
Wow.
For gas. Yeah. And a lot of that has to do with the extortionate taxes that they have in California that are added on to the cost of the fuel itself. And this sort of thing is being pushed at the national level by the Biden thing, who's determined to force everybody into this supposed green electrified future, which means our bleak and insurgent future, where we can't afford to operate vehicles anymore, where we can't afford to maintain lawnmowers anymore, and therefore can't afford to live in the suburbs in the country anymore, and can all be herded into our nice stack of coal apartments somewhere in an urban hive, which is controlled by people like the Biden thing. That's their end goal here.
So my question is, why would Putin do this to us?
Right.
Well, I mean, he's the one they're blaming, but obviously, you know, there has been such a giant step backward just since Biden took office in January of 2021. It seems like every bit of policy regarding energy has been to step back away from fossil fuels and to make it as difficult and as costly as possible for us to get them.
Yeah, you know, people are gullible, unfortunately, but they're not that gullible. From what I've gathered, every poll, every survey done so far indicates that, by and large, most people are not buying it. You know, they are well aware of the fact that even if they didn't like the Orange Man, gas was about $2 a gallon when Orange Man bad. And it only began to go up after Orange Man left and the Biden thing came in. And long before Putin reared his head and this whole Ukraine business burbled up. In fact, it was months and months and months of rising gas prices. So you simply cannot say that it's because Putin reared his head.
No.
You know, it's just obviously idiotic. And I think only a few idiots out there actually buy into it. And I think that probably explains why the Biden thing's approval ratings continue to take a dump. And the thing that interests me about that is, and it alarms me, is that these Democrats, these socialists, they don't seem to care anymore whether they're popular. They don't seem to have any concern at all about electoral consequences. This creature that shambles around in the White House has less than like a 30% approval rating right now. It's absolutely devastating, assuming they think there are going to be elections and that they're going to be held accountable by the voters at some point.
I'll tell you, one of the things that is getting my attention, and this is causing a little bit of the beginnings of an ulcer for me. I live and work in a rural area. I work from home in a very rural area. I have farm fields all around me. I see the farm equipment that is out there getting those fields ready to plant and working those fields. And if I'm understanding correctly, I've talked to a couple of different farmers. What they paid for a tanker load of diesel back in September of 2020, you know, they may have paid $10,000 for a great big tank of diesel that they would use to keep those farm vehicles, the tractors and whatnot, going. But as of March of this year, that same tanker load of diesel was well north of $30,000.
Correct. It's frightening, isn't it? And it goes beyond merely that. You know, petroleum products are intimately related to fertilizer and to the ability to keep the crops productive at the same level that we've been used to in the past. All of this indicates that we're headed for some kind of a titanic crash of food supplies or just a titanic increase in the cost of food. And bear in mind, there's synergy. There's also this whole thing with the inflation, which really is devaluation. So whatever money we have continues to be bled away by the infusion of more and more money into the system by the Biden thing. So it's this combination of factors that has the potential for absolutely catastrophic effects in terms of people not being able to buy food. There not being any food. And this is a real thing, and people should be worried about it.
Yeah, I especially feel for the people who live in urban settings, because their options of producing more of their own food, or for that matter, you know, working out agreements with someone who keeps chickens or cattle or goats or whatever, they're very limited. And so I don't know, man. I'm not trying to make it sound like, hey, doomsday's coming, but I'm thinking if you're serious about standing on your own feet, you might want to get out of those population centers where control is made so much easier for those in power.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, people have gotten used to the kind of civilizational structure that we've had in this country for the past 100 years now. And they don't worry about having more than a couple of days worth of food in the house. They don't worry about whether the air conditioning or the heat is going to work, the lights are going to come on, whether the fridge is going to be there, all of these things. They should begin worrying about them. If the power goes out, and they've already been hinting, the government has been hinting out loud that there are going to be brownouts this summer.
Yep.
And there's no food on the shelves, or they can't afford to buy food. What now? I remember reading a book. I can't recall the title of it, but something to the effect that for most people who live in cities and urban areas, they've got about 3 days before they start to starve if they can't get food at the supermarket. And you can imagine the social repercussions if a scenario like that begins to develop.
Oh, yeah. Well, and this comes back to, we often talk about electric vehicles and the push to get everybody into electric vehicles. I mean, come on, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, well, if you can't afford gas, buy an electric car.
Yeah.
But if there are going to be rolling blackouts or even brownouts, does that not sound an alarm bell for people who are, you know, leaning towards EVs? And how are you going to charge your EV if electricity is in short supply?
It ought to. And people like Buttigieg and those like him are contemptible people. It is despicable to tell somebody who's out there driving a 12-year-old car because that's all they can afford and who's looking at having to put $100 worth of gas into their vehicle and who makes maybe $25,000 a year or $30,000 a year, oh, yeah, go out and buy a $40,000 electric car, buddy. I mean, that kind of callousness and glibness toward the sufferings that are being inflicted on people. And keep in mind, this is not natural. This is not a phenomenon that just arose and, boy, you know, it really stinks, but we have to do our best to try to deal with it. This is entirely artificial, and it's created by people like Buttigieg and the Biden thing.
Well, and I don't know what to tell people other than, you know, you've got to make your own decisions about where your line is drawn. All I know is, for me, those who are in power are not in any meaningful way representing me or my interests. And therefore, if there's a social contract, as they like to insist, Brian, you have to follow this. Not if you've broken it. I don't. I'll do what I have to do to protect myself and my family.
Yes. You make a very interesting and astute point, which is, I think, that it's no longer the case that, well, we have two different points of view, Democrats and Republicans, about certain things. But fundamentally, we're all interested in the same thing, which is the good of the country and the good of the people. It's become quite clear that the people, at least at the federal level and a lot of people at the state level, who are actively opposed to the interests of Americans, working against them, for their own benefit in a way that's never happened before in this country. And I agree with you. At that point, we're no longer bound by the things that we were once bound by, because we have no voice. We have no choice other than to say, no, we're not going to put up with it.
Yep. Yep. I'm going to continue to be a peaceful individual, but I'm also going to I'll stop asking permission. And by your leave, may I continue to feed my family? I'll do what I need to do to take care of them. And I will urge others to consider doing the same. Eric, great to visit with you as always. Tell people where they can find your website.
Oh, sure. It's etautos.com, and they can just look my name up on any search engine and they'll find myself that way too.
Okay. Great to visit with you as always. I feel a little more sane after every conversation we have.
Likewise, that goes both ways. Thank you, Brian.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
All right, welcome back to the show. And a shout out to Dixie Chiropractic. That's the practice of Dr. Ward Wagner. You can go to their website, dixiechiro.com. Dr. Wagner has asked me specifically to reach out to three groups of people. People who are suffering from neuropathy, those who are suffering from bulging herniated discs, and also anybody who is dealing with car accident injuries. If you go to the website, dixiechiro.com, you'll see some great options available to anybody who is dealing with these types of pain. For instance, for neuropathy, you can check out the $99 Calmer treatment plus massage. If you're dealing with herniated discs, here's a $99 intro special with two treatments plus massage. All the details are there at the website, dixiechiro.com. Sure appreciate them being a sponsor of this program. I know sometimes it must feel like, you know, Brian, it seems like you're always talking about the end of the world. And I have some clarification to offer on this. I don't believe that it's the end of the world. Now, let me clarify that by saying I do believe that the world as we know it, the way things used to be, think back 3 years ago. Yeah, it's definitely the end of that world. But as you know, life goes on, and those who are paying attention have options that those who are just kind of walking around in conditioned white with their head in the clouds and daydreaming, or perhaps distracted by the latest, you know, what are the Kardashians up to or whatever, they're not going to see it coming. And the point is, there are things that have happened before that have radically altered the way the world is. We are going through one of those cycles right now. I share what I share with you not to, you know, pretend that this is the end. This is it. You know, all is lost, because I don't think all is lost. But I definitely think we've got to be okay with things changing. And that means you got to be keeping your eye on a number of different factors. For instance, the monetary system. Are you looking at some of the challenges that are taking place there? A lot of sand has gone through the hourglass. There are very few grains remaining. Something is going to have to change soon. What we are doing right now, the system, the monetary system as it is, isn't sustainable. Got a great article here from Robert E. Wright, from the American Institute for Economic Research. It's titled Preparing for Payment System Fragility. This one's worth your time. He says, in previous posts, I've suggested ways to cope with rising prices, cost of living, food insecurity, wild game, and Liberty Gardens. But he says, inflation creates many problems, including an increased risk of payment system glitches, like the shuttering of banking and credit card networks, leaving individuals economically stranded. Cyber attacks, power outages, financial crises, and other shocks can slow or even disable the payment system. So he says, true, a de facto or de jure moratorium on payments would ensue, but don't forget that if you can't make your payments, your employer and other debtors like Social Security or retirement or investment funds may not be able to pay you either. And he asks, how then will you buy gas or groceries? Well, the most obvious way to hedge against the payment system risk is to hold some cash. Many people who lived through the Great Depression stockpiled paper money for the rest of their lives just in case their bank went under or the ghost of Roosevelt, the president who seized their gold, declared another bank holiday. But he says few of those people are left, however, and many members of our youngest adult generation go out of their way to avoid carrying cash. In fact, he says even some old timers like me use paper notes only when absolutely necessary. Moreover, he writes, it would be rather daft to hold on to much fiscal cash when I-series bonds are yielding north of 9%. Now, that's still a losing proposition in inflation-adjusted terms, but literally better than the nothing those limp pieces of paper pay. So if you think that you'll just saunter down to your bank and fill out a withdrawal slip like it was 1999, think again. Even if some banks remain open, they hold very little physical cash these days. Any functioning ATMs will also be quickly stripped. Given the current rate of inflation, he says a better approach might be to stockpile the non-perishables that you will need. Gasoline is tricky, but many foods can be stocked for long periods. As long as you eat it up before it goes bad, it will actually save you money by buying now instead of after prices go up again. So what happened the last time America's payment system crashed during the Great Depression? Well, he says various local and state systems failed repeatedly, starting in 1930, and in early March 1933, President Roosevelt euphemistically declared a national bank holiday. To stop currency hoarding, gold exportation, and bank failures, the new commander-in-chief shut down all of the nation's banks, including the Federal Reserve banks, under the authority of Section 4305 of the Trading with the Enemy Act of 1917. When the national emergency would end, no one knew. Yet little riotous looting occurred. Americans remained calm and made do, adapting to circumstances in nuanced ways. Some municipalities, for example, kindly locked up perpetrators who could not pay cash fines, giving them three hots and a cot for a day. Though unconstitutional, other municipalities issued tax anticipation scrip to employees who then made local payments with it. Some churches stopped passing the collection plate, while others accepted handwritten IOUs. More formally, the IRS accepted checks that it knew it could not deposit for collection until after the crisis. Private businesses also responded according to circumstances. Railroads, for example, allowed passengers to travel home without tickets. Guardian Life Insurance Company of America, a mutual life insurer, rightly felt that it had to make prompt payment of all verified death claims, so it always kept more cash on hand than its for-profit competitors did. During the bank holiday, it used its stash of cash to buy money orders, which it sent to beneficiaries via American Express. If the money order system had also shut down, it was prepared to courier physical cash to beneficiaries from the home office in Manhattan, or direct its local agents to make cash down payments on its behalf. Robert E. Wright says it probably could have borrowed informally, too, from the few companies that found themselves with large and hence dangerous sums of cash on hand. Short-term interest rates were understandably high. Businesses that did not want to expose their money to default risk in uncertain times induced local police stations and private security firms to safeguard their cash. He says most wholesale businesses, manufacturers, importers, and the like, sold to each other and to retailers on credit. So most responded to the crisis simply by extending credit lines to existing trading partners. Many retailers did likewise. General credit cards were a post-war phenomenon. In the 1930s, many retailers maintained book accounts, much as colonial retailers did, or they issued their own charge cards. But not everyone had credit accounts everywhere they shopped, so some large employers paid their employees or their workers with IOUs that local retailers were happier to accept than the promises of the poor working stiffs. Small change was in such short supply that some retailers sent shills to competitors to buy trifles with $20 bills. Some businesses responded by saying that customers could tender whatever denomination they liked, but no change would be made. Perhaps most tragically of all, many a piggy bank met an untimely death, seemingly vindicating those who kept coins in easily opened glass jars. But precisely because the piggies could be raided only by destroying them, they served as commitment devices and hence held more coins, all else constant, than the jars did. Some bartering also began to break out before the holiday ended. So by mid-March, most of the banks that would reopen, keep in mind some 4,000 closed permanently, already had, and the payment system had returned to its normal fragile self. The crisis led directly to the formation of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which has proven itself a wash at best. It also led to a large devaluation of the U.S. dollar and the demise of domestic gold holdings and retail gold convertibility. In other words, Americans today still suffer the costs imposed by government's New Deal solutions. Now, Robert E. Wright asks the question, what would Americans get if the payment system shuts down again? Well, that would depend on the exact nature of the crisis, but a central bank digital currency, CBDC, is a good guess. Most retailers today are not prepared to extend credit to their customers and no longer even have a way to take credit card impressions. So maybe it would dawn on them to snap pics of credit or debit cards, but many customers might worry about allowing them to do that. Innovators might come up with other clever workarounds, but most businesses will be afraid to do anything without regulatory pre-approval. Bitcoin on the blockchain or via Lightning Network or fintech platforms like Venmo might seize market share, but not very much if on and off ramps remain blocked. As tensions mount, people will call upon the government to do something, just as in March of 2020. Robert E. Wright says, one can almost hear President Biden or Harris mumbling through a Rooseveltian, "You have everything to fear except CBDC," speech. But he says at least Twitter users will be able to demur openly. Not that it matters, or not that it will matter. Kind of an interesting question to ponder, isn't it? And I'm not telling you there's one answer and one answer only of what to do. Personally, I think tangible goods, something you can actually put your mitts on, is a pretty good way to store value. But it's not the only answer, right? So maybe a little bit of diversification in your portfolio. All I know is this is the time to sort it out now, before there's a crisis.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. I want to give a shout out to sewingandquiltingcenter.com. Now, this is a family-owned business located in St. George, Utah. But if you live anywhere in southern Utah, and I'm talking, you know, if you're within a couple hundred mile radius, you should probably talk to them, because I bet somebody in your family understands the importance of having a good working sewing machine or a serger, or maybe they do long-arm quilting. This is the place where you need to go, not only for the machines, but for the service to keep them running for generations, also for training on how to use them. I think this is one of the neatest things that I've heard, and that is Sewing and Quilting Center will actually teach you how to use your machine. It's not like, well, you bought it, now good luck, you're on your own. They'll actually teach you how to get the most out of it. And, of course, they sell all the supplies that go along with it. Look, this business has been in operation since 1984. Teresa and Eric Alsop are the current owners. They're wonderful people. They are there to help you. So, again, if you or someone you know really understands the importance of sewing or quilting or embroidery, this is the place you need to go. Sewingandquiltingcenter.com. You know, for all the talk that we hear about disinformation, what really worries the ruling class, the reason they're always going on and on about disinformation, is that they are afraid we will recognize the reality of what they're up to. In other words, Caitlin Johnstone puts it this way. They're worried about the spread of information, not disinformation. This is her latest column, and she says, we're in the final countdown to British Home Secretary Priti Patel's decision, rather, on the fate of Julian Assange, with the WikiLeaks founder's extradition to the United States due to be approved or rejected by the end of the month. Joe Lauria has a new article out with Consortium News on the various pressures that Patel is being faced with from both sides of this history-making issue at this crucial time. And she says, I can't stop thinking as this situation comes to a boil, how absurd it is that the U.S. empire is working to set a precedent which essentially outlaws information sharing that the U.S. doesn't like, at the same time Western news media are full of hand-wringing headlines about the dangerous threat of disinformation. Case in point, this is from fair.org. Disinformation label serves to marginalize crucial Ukraine facts. Yeah. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting actually is calling out the way the mass media have been spinning that label to mean not only knowing the distribution of false information, but also of information that's true and is inconvenient to imperial narrative weaving. Fair's Luca Goldmansauer says, in defense of the U.S. narrative, corporate media have increasingly taken to branding realities inconvenient to U.S. information goals as disinformation spread by Russia or its proxies. She says, online platforms have been ramping up their censorship protocols under the banner of fighting disinformation and misinformation. And those escalations always align with narrative control agendas of the U.S. centralized empire. For instance, Caitlin Johnstone says just the other day, we learned that Twitter has a new policy which expands its censorship practices to fight misinformation about wars and other crises. And the Ukraine war, surprise, surprise, will be the first such situation about which it will be enforcing these new censorship policies. Then there's the recent controversy over the Department of Homeland Security's Disinformation Governance Board, a mysterious institution ostensibly designed to protect the American people from wrongthink coming from Russia and elsewhere. The board's operations, whatever they were, have been paused pending a review which will be led by Michael Chertoff, a virulent swamp monster and torture advocate. Remember him? He was the first Secretary of Homeland Defense. And its operations will likely be resumed in one form or another, probably under the leadership of someone with a low profile who doesn't sing show tunes about disinformation. And this all comes out after U.S. officials straight up told the press that the Biden administration has been deliberately sowing disinformation to the public using mainstream press in order to win an info war against the Kremlin. She has links to this, by the way. This is not something she's pulling out of thin air. Caitlin Johnstone says they've literally just been circulating completely baseless stories about Russia and Ukraine, but nobody seems to be calling for the social media accounts of Biden administration officials to be banned. Now, she says, you're seeing so many discrepancies between what the oligarchic empire says and what it actually does regarding the issue of disinformation, because the empire has no problem with disinformation. The empire that is built on propaganda and lies has no problem with propaganda and lies. It has a problem with the truth. They're not worried about disinformation. They're worried about information. They're worried about journalists using the unprecedented information sharing power of the internet to reveal inconvenient facts about the largest and most murderous power structure on earth. They're worried about people finding out that they've been lied to their entire lives about their world, their nation, and their government. They're worried about people using their newly connected minds to decide together that they don't much like the status quo as it's been laid out for them and deciding to build a new one. So all the safeguards they're now setting up to manipulate the flow of information online are not there to eliminate lies. They're there to eliminate the truth. These people have a vested interest in keeping things dark and confused. And we, the ordinary people of the world, have a vested interest in shining a big, inconvenient spotlight on everything. The elite agenda to keep things darkened is at direct odds with the people's agenda to get things enlightened. Now, Caitlin Johnstone says we're not being protected by a compassionate alliance of corporations and governments who only want us to know the truth. We're being manipulated and oppressed by an oligarchic empire that wants us to believe lies. That's why they're locking up Julian Assange. That's why they're censoring the internet. That's why they're filling our minds with propaganda. And that's why we can't let them win. Now, I don't know how that strikes you. I mean, I'm guessing you wouldn't be listening to this program if you didn't at least believe, okay, that's plausible. I may not agree, but I think it could be plausible. Actually, I think it makes great sense. In fact, I haven't seen very many people who can summarize it as beautifully and succinctly as Caitlin Johnstone does. But there are still a shocking number of people out there who seem really concerned and really upset when someone differs from the official government line. And I'm not trying to be unkind when I say this, so please don't think, here we go, it's licensed to start calling people names and assuming that they're stupid or they're evil. But I have to wonder how broken a person must be, at least mentally. They've been I don't know what the mental equivalent of housebroken is, but to be looking for a reason, any shred of reason to believe that my government would not lie to me. And if it ever did, the media would surely tell us all about it. They would make sure that we knew. I had someone ask me once in a job interview, you know, it looks like you have kind of an axe to grind with Heritage Media. And my first inclination was like, well, I don't know, you know, if that's the way to put it. But in retrospect, yeah, I actually do. I have a big axe to grind. And the main reason I have that axe to grind is because I've been paying attention long enough and I've worked within media long enough that I recognize how much deception goes on a daily basis. And the crazy thing about it, and maybe people outside of the media recognize this very readily. I can tell you anybody who's worked within media has a pretty good feel for there's always a decision to be made about, well, what's worth covering? What is worth telling? And most often the deception that you and I are going to encounter in our day-to-day lives isn't going to be some big, bald-faced lie, just, you know, trotted out there. Well, you know, the moon really is made of green cheese. And, you know, we're just expected to suspend disbelief and absolutely embrace it. No, it's more the things that we're not being told. In other words, there's context lacking. There are inconvenient facts, like we talked about. You know, anything that disappoints or that otherwise threatens the narrative is pretended to not even exist. So it's the omission of pertinent facts, as well as the way things are sometimes shaded to, well, you know, so-and-so claimed that they hadn't done this, you know, whereas when it's a government source, government officials affirmed that this is the case. And, you know, it's subtle, but you learn that language can be manipulated, and sometimes the choice of words requires a little bit closer parsing and understanding of what exactly are they trying to say here. Or maybe, as the case is, what are they trying not to say? The bottom line is this, though. The propaganda is real. It is thick as flies. And the only hope you have is to become as propaganda-proof as you can as an individual. Now, that means some effort, right? This means you've got to be the one to essentially sharpen your own blade, you know, as far as being able to discern fact from fiction. That's not something that's just naturally, you know, born into you. It's not an inborn, you know, trait. You have to work to develop it. You have to develop a healthy sense of skepticism. And this is probably the toughest part of all. You've got to learn to trust your judgment. If something seems off or manipulative, chances are good, you're right.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.